When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Just a quick heads up, there's a little swearing in this episode. Casey, how many conversations do you think you have had since the 2016 election about how internet platforms and social media are hurting democracy?
I mean, it's sort of become the background chatter to every conversation I have about my beat.
Casey Newton writes the newsletter Platformer, and he's been reporting on tech and the internet for years.
You know, when I started covering these issues, I don't think the sort of intersection of tech and democracy had not been a particularly hot topic. And then in the wake of the election, it was sort of all anyone wanted to talk about. And it sort of felt like we spent the 5 years after the election just sort of reliving it every day.
It's something we've covered extensively on this show. The idea that social media algorithms are primed to amplify content that is outrageous or offensive, to spread misinformation about COVID-19 or conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, or to be used to incite events like the Capitol riots.
I think it's pretty common now in the Twitter timeline to see people taking it as a given that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube are all working together to destroy democracy. I have long argued that it is more complicated than that, because for every, 2016 election where you have Russians interfering, you also have the Me Too movement, you have Black Lives Matter, you have gay marriage, just like stuff that was playing out on social networks that was able to rally a lot of people around those causes, arguably to create a progressive effect.
In Ukraine, Casey says, we're watching a small country use the internet as a force multiplier.
And so now here you have this situation in Ukraine where, once again, we're seeing how people sort of on the margins, right, the underdog in this war against Russia, are able to appeal directly to a large global audience and rally the entire Western world to their side.
Today on the show, Casey argues that in this war, social media is helping defend democracy.
If you think that social networks can only be used for bad, then I think the situation in Ukraine should give you reason to reflect.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick with us.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Before the invasion started, there's this vaunted Russian disinformation machine. Were you expecting it would own the internet narrative of what was happening?
To some extent, yes. The conversation about the Russian information operation since 2016 has been to lionize it. And there was this assumption that if an invasion happened, it would be coupled with some sort of mass manipulation campaign. I think we really have to credit the Biden administration for calling Putin's shot in advance, because it just made it exponentially harder for Putin to gain any ground in controlling this narrative, right? When the Biden administration is saying this guy's about to invade a country for no reason, and then he does it, very hard to launch a misinformation campaign that's going to change anybody's minds.
How is Russia gonna get their message out?
Up until 3 or 4 days ago, there was a sort of easy answer to this question, which is they would get it out on RT and Sputnik, right? So in 2005, they start this TV channel called RT, formerly Russia Today, and they start building up presences on all the major platforms, and they're really clever about it. It's not just 24/7 Russians complaining about Yankee imperialist pigs. It's, crazy weather videos and cute animals and other viral junk that they're putting on YouTube and other platforms in order to attract, you know, what we would call an organic audience. And then every once in a while, you know, you just slip in that Americans are capitalist dogs. And over time, you're able to kind of build up your propaganda machine. For years, these platforms have faced calls to remove these platforms entirely, or to at least make it harder for people to find them. The platforms resisted that for a long time. Starting in about 2017, they did start to take some measures. But then the invasion happened, and the leaders of Ukraine started tweeting, please get rid of these propaganda networks, which are all over Europe. You know, they're carried on the Dish Network and DirecTV, right? It's like a sort of like shockingly mainstream, even if it doesn't have a huge audience. And finally, everybody started to act in concert, just as they have on so many things related to the invasion. And now you cannot find these channels on many TV networks and services around the world. They have been pulled from the App Store and the Google Play Store. Throughout Europe. Russia is not going to be able to use these to get its message out.
As we've all seen over the past week, Ukrainians have repeatedly used the internet to showcase the horror of Russian attacks. But they've also showed a kind of uncowed irrepressibility that plays particularly well on an internet always looking for viral moments.
Всім добрий вечір. Лідер фракції тут.
Like President Zelensky's cell phone videos from the street, or the sailors at Snake Island reportedly telling a Russian warship, go fuck yourself. Or Ukraine's, frankly, sassy official Twitter account, which asked for donations in cryptocurrency and immediately raised millions.
The thing that we hate about the internet is that it is so big and it is so fast, right? And so if I want to say something terrible, I can reach a lot of people in a hurry with that. And yet that same dynamic is incredible for fundraising. When there is the biggest crisis in the world of the moment, and you have the attention of most of planet Earth, you can raise an insane amount of money in a hurry, right? And so I'm somebody who worries about the lack of friction on the internet basically every day. And yet here is a case where it is clearly being used for good.
I do think we need to acknowledge that the ability of regular people to show the horrors of war, right? They can do it on TikTok, on Telegram, on Instagram. But this is not the first social media war. People have been saying, oh, Ukraine. No. Was very much happening in Syria, but it didn't move international opinion and policy in the same way. In terms of what makes this different, there's the obvious question of race, but I also wonder if there's something in the way we are consuming social media now or in the way it's being deployed.
It's hard for me to think of something about the design of these systems that has changed fundamentally between Syria and Ukraine. I do think that there is a significant degree of racism in the way that we have been treating these stories. I also think that we just sort of allot our attention differently based on, in part, like the geopolitical importance of the question. And that's not a good thing, but I do think it's a reality.
On a practical level, though, like I wonder, listening to you talk about sort of engagement engines, if there's a self-fulfilling cycle there, right? So if you are maybe primed to follow that news and you are clicking on that content and you are maybe amplifying it and sharing it, does that then spin out to kind of boost it more and more?
I think it does. And you know, something that I would say that I think is different here is, to the extent that there was something novel in the social media dynamics, look at the Ukraine Twitter account, right? I mean, they're tweeting stuff like, what do you think of, like, Russia? Like, tag them, you know? They're posting memes, and they're calling on platforms directly saying, remove this from your app store, remove that, ban Russia from the internet, right? And so they've used Twitter for activism in a way that I cannot recall another country or another group of freedom fighters doing. And that, I think, just sort of speaks to the power of Twitter in particular to really focus that. It's like a magnifying lens to just, like, focus the energy of the internet on a particular subject.
The major platforms have largely worked alongside Ukraine and Western governments, or acquiesced to their demands. Facebook restricted access to RT and Sputnik. Twitter has added state media labels to their links. Google and Apple have disabled live traffic data, so it can't be used for military targeting.
I write about these platforms more like they're quasi-states than they are corporations, because they're just so big. You know, they have, like, billions of users. They're borderless. And so I think they have to practice diplomacy like any other state. And essentially what we've learned is that they are aligned with the Western international order. And it makes sense. Like, these businesses only exist because of the rule of law, because of democracy and the right to self-determination. We shouldn't find it unusual that they are aligning themselves with those groups. You know, more practically, they're aligning themselves with everyone with the power to regulate them.
Right.
Now, there's an asterisk on that, because Russia has been trying aggressively to regulate them and has been trying to prevent them from taking some of the measures that they've done. But I think it's fair game for American companies to say, when there's an attack on a Western democracy, on one of our allies, we're going to do largely what the government asks us to do to aid in the resistance.
There's another question for tech companies that have employees in Russia or do business there. It's called the landing law. And I wonder if you could explain kind of what that is and the quandary it puts some of these companies in.
Yeah, so there's this new trend among authoritarian regimes, although it's not just authoritarian regimes, that says, if you want to operate in our country, you're going to have to incorporate a local business here that has a physical office, and you're going to have to designate a local representative that we can complain to if we find something that we don't like on one of your platforms. In practice, what this means is that there is now a person who can be physically intimidated if the government doesn't like what they see. You know, we've already seen this to some degree in India, where, like, the SWAT teams are raiding the offices of Twitter because the Modi government didn't like a label that had been placed on a tweet. And you have now something very similar in Russia, which is called the landing law. And the whole idea is they want to be able to pressure these platforms into doing their bidding, no matter what it is. And so last November, when Russia had elections, there was an app that helped people coordinate their votes against Putin. You know, the idea was, instead of splitting our votes between many candidates, this app would figure out who you would cast your vote for to maximize the chance of sort of gaining ground against Putin. And Putin insisted that platforms remove this app from the App Store, and initially they resisted, but then they went out and he intimidated all of their employees, you know, and threatened them with jail or worse, and lo and behold, those apps got removed from the App Store. So that's a really scary precedent to me, the idea that, you know, you're threatening to physically injure someone in order to get apps removed from App Stores, but that's the world we're living in now.
Do you think any of this, the landing law, the intimidation around the App Store, does it make these companies reassess doing business in Russia? It's a huge market.
I was talking with a sort of high-level platform executive about this question last year, and they were saying that journalists always approach this as a binary question, right? Like, you're either there or you're not. And if a country does one bad thing, you should pull out and really stick it to them. But
pretty
when you
big
do that,
bad thing.
I agree. Listen, I agree. But The flip side of that is that the moment that you do that, to the extent that your services are used by journalists, they're used by human rights workers, nonprofit organizations, members of the resistance, rival politicians, you're taking away those tools and services and infrastructure. So could you maybe do more good by finding a way to remain? So, you know, there are a lot of people at the big platforms who feel like, to the extent that they can do that dance and remain in the country, they can do the most good. And, you know, I think if you contrast Russia with China, Russia has much worse control over its internet, right? It hasn't built up nearly the same infrastructure to surveil people, to censor people, which means that, you know, in practice, you could probably get much better information on YouTube, for example, than you could on Russian state media. And, you know, if you want Russians to have credible independent media at a time where, you know, the day that we're recording this, like all of these independent media outlets in Russia are just saying that they have to shut down because, you know, Russia has basically declared them illegal, YouTube might be the best shot that many average Russians have for getting independent media.
When we come back, how Ukraine and the Arab Spring are connected.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Listening to Casey talk, it was hard not to think about the Arab Spring and how, for a moment, it felt like the world was connected in a good way. Like Twitter and Facebook were giving activists a degree of power they didn't have before. But then that moment ended.
The Arab Spring is such an important moment in the history of the platforms because it is where they got their moral certainty that what they were doing was good for the world and that if they could reach as many people as possible in the world, they could do a maximum amount of good. And then what happened is that a lot of strongmen saw what had happened during the Arab Spring and they said, well, we're actually going to use these tools for evil and we're going to get really good at it. And then they did. And then, you know, all of the like pro-democracy organizers had a much more difficult time. But, you know, I think there's an interesting connection between the Arab Spring and the Ukraine, which is like they're both one-sided information wars, right? Like in the Arab Spring, you know, you weren't seeing a bunch of strongmen on Twitter being really clever with their tweets.
Right. Mubarak was not out there tweeting.
Exactly. And so the pro-democracy forces essentially had Twitter to themselves. And you're seeing a similar thing here.
Have you talked to people inside the big platforms about what is happening and how their content and actions are contributing to it?
Yeah, so in the past week, I have spoken with folks at Google and Facebook and Twitter about what's going on. And what they have signaled to me is that they really want to help. Like whatever they can do with their platforms, they want to. There are some practical questions. There are some fears that they have about, for example, removing RT and Sputnik from their services completely. They're waiting to take cues from the Biden administration. So basically, if the Biden administration asks them to do something, they're going to be much likelier to do it than if they just sort of have to like guess what the right move is. But they're very committed to doing what they can to help Ukraine via their platform policies.
We talked a little bit about how these platforms, you know, can be viewed as nation states, right? They're huge. Do you think this conflict changes at all the relationship between these platforms and the US or the EU, you know, places that have been trying to rein them in and regulate them?
I think it's been a moment for the platforms to say, look at the good we can do. You want us in the world. We can help fight for freedom, right? Like that's been the message they want to send. The platforms have had such a rough half decade that any moment where they can try to take a leadership position and try to do something that regulators will praise them for, they're very excited about. So I think they've seen this as that moment. And, you know, frankly, like none of them have gone rogue with their policies. Nobody's getting creative. Everybody is sort of following each other's lead. And the lead is coming from the US government and from like the EU and the UK. So I would say that this has shown the degree to which they are not like nation states. Like in this case, they really just are acting like corporations in wartime that are, you know, trying to support the domestic politics.
Casey Newton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Casey Newton writes the newsletter Platformer. That is it for the show today. TBD is produced by Ethan Brooks. We're edited by Tori Bosch. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and it's also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And I want to recommend that you go back and listen to Wednesday's episode of What Next. It helped me understand Vladimir Putin a lot better. We will be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.